This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.
We can never know about the days to come. But we think about them anyway. And I wonder if I'm really with you now, or just chasing after some finer day. Anticipation is making me rain.
It's hard, if not impossible, to imagine the 1970s without musician Carly Simon. She gained near-instant fame after opening for Cat Stevens at L.A.'s Troubadour in 1971. Within a year, she would make a chart-topping album, win a Grammy, and marry singer James Taylor. Her music spoke to the openness of her generation and earned her critical acclaim worldwide. In hits like You're So Vain, Carly Simon exuded fearlessness, poise, but backstage she was grasping for both. She disliked the spotlight and had to will herself out of a case of stage fright to continue performing. When Carly Simon started out, she never planned on performing.
When I started recording, that was all I was going to do. I wasn't going to get out on stage and do anything on stage. I wanted to make demos for other people to record my songs. So I recorded hoping that Dionne Warwick would record one, hoping that Judy Collins would record something. You know, I just made a glorified demo. It turned out to be so glorified that we had string players and we had arrangements, and things got more and more. It became something that a record company wanted. So Elektra Records signed me, and that was Jack Holzman, who was the head of Elektra at that time.
How old were you?
25.
You were young.
Yeah.
Very young.
Well, yes.
And what was the song you were trying to demo that Jack Holzman said, let's put this out with you singing? What was that song?
Well, the first demo I made in a studio had five songs, which was just me and guitar and another cat named Dave Bromberg on guitar. Five songs, two of which I think made it to the next demo. There was a song called Alone, which I wrote on the beach in Martha's Vineyard about being alone and romantic and happy. And there was another song called I'm All It Takes to Make You Happy. There was happy songs. Then there was a song that I wrote with Jake Brackman called That's the Way I've Always Heard It Should Be. And that song I played on piano. And that got to the next demo. And Jack Holzman heard that. Clive Davis heard it first, and as did a bunch of other people. And they heard my first demo, and they didn't know what to make of me. They didn't know if I was a jazz singer, a blues singer, a rock and roll singer, a theater singer, a cabaret singer. They didn't know how to apply me to the merchandising scheme.
Did you try to suggest to them what kind of singer you were?
No, because I didn't fit my own self into a category. I had imitated a whole lot of people, and I had developed my own voice, but with so many influences that I hadn't cut myself off from my influences and made a whole me. The umbilical cord was still attached to Odetta, was still attached to Annie Ross of Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross, still attached to Pete Seeger, to the various influences. I mean, I still have trouble with that. People say that the reason that I haven't been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is that that I'm not really a rock and roll singer, or that I sort of go in a lot of different directions. I've made four albums of standards, for example, which I didn't write, which were written by Cole Porter and George Gershwin and Rodgers and Hart and the great people who could write great songs for singers, because they weren't one and the same in that period.
But what's interesting to me is that when you are 25 years old, That's the Way It Always Should Be is your first song. It's a hit song.
Yes, yes.
And you wrote that with Jake.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to explain to people, because many people know Jake Brackman as a famous songwriter and partner of yours. Where did you meet him?
I met Jake at summer camp. We were both counselors, at Indian Hill Camp in the Berkshires. And Jake was the swimming counselor, and he also taught literature. These were very arty kids, and I was the guitar teacher. All the kids met me for the first time. They had known each other from the summer before. Jake wasn't there yet because he had hepatitis and was in the hospital. But they said, oh, wait till you meet Jake. You'll just fall in love with each other or be friends for the rest of your life. I don't think anybody had ever quite introduced me to somebody before I actually met them with those terms, that we'd be lifelong friends. And the day that he got there, they prepared a cookout. The campers did. And they said, now we want you to come down to the cookout, and Jake will come down to the cookout, and you'll stand opposite each other, but with your backs to each other. And at the count of three, you'll turn toward each other.
And lightning will strike
you. And you'll see what we mean about that you're two halves of one person. And so it was one, two, three, and we turned across this fire, which was raging between us, and we both smiled, and we recognized each other in ourselves and vice versa. And it was quite amazing. And Jake just dropped me off here today.
What was it about him? Was he writing songs then? Was he was a musician and into songwriting? And
no, Jake was, at that point, he had just graduated from Harvard. He was the editor of The Crimson, and he went in, he was writing for Newsweek magazine. He was writing for Talk of the Town. And he was the young writer on the scene. He was the young prose writer on the scene. When we started writing songs together, he then also got into working with Terrence Malick, and he worked on Days of Heaven and on Badlands, and he wrote King of Marvin Gardens.
With
Jack Nicholson in that. And so he's a man of all words, most of them quite funny. He's an unusual character.
Beyond journalism, Jake, and screenwriting, he was a lyricist. He was writing lyrics?
Well, he had never written lyrics before, but I had this melody. Da 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 da, and the whole song, because I'd written that for an NBC special called Who Killed Lake Erie. That was the background music for that. So when I was going to make this demo, I couldn't get lyrics for it, because if I write a melody first, I can't seem to find lyrics to it. It's got to be the other way around. I write lyrics first. And so I had this melody, and Jake was by then my best friend. And I said, do you want to try to write a lyric? So I gave him, on a little cassette, I gave him that melody. And he came back a day or two later with a full lyric, except for one verse, which we edited out.
My friends from college, they're all married now. They have their houses and their lawns. They have their silent noons, tearful nights, angry dawns. Their children hate them for the things they're not. They hate themselves for what they are. And yet they drink, they laugh, close the wound, hide the scar.
The lyrics, because there's very pungent lyrics in that song.
They
hate themselves for what they are.
Very good.
Who is he talking about?
Well, his girlfriend was just about to move in with him. Jake and I lived one block away from each other, but we shared each other's lives, and our friends were each other's friends, and I met most of the people that I know today through Jake, or vice versa. So his girlfriend, Ricky, was just about to move in with him, and he realized that she was going to be moving into his rooms, and that's an invasion of territory for certain people. And it means a whole lot. It means not only are you going to be in my rooms, but I'm not going to be able to get you out of my rooms if you're living with me. So from Jake's point of view, that song was, are we going to marry? Are we not going to marry? And we had talked a lot about marriage and a lot about the fact that being in love with somebody, living with somebody, didn't necessarily indicate that you had to get married, as it
when you
had
your
in,
situation
the, in the Eisenhower years were different.
What situation of yours were you referring
well,
to? Men in your life?
Every man that I was with, I felt I had to marry. If I was going to sleep with them or if I was going to have sex with them in any way, I felt as if I had to marry them and have children.
That's exhausting.
Them.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
And so times were changing.
Sure.
And this was a very different era. The Kennedy years were upon us, and the hippiedom, the Woodstock era, the times were hugely changing. I mean, I didn't necessarily have to marry the person that you were living with and raise a family of our own, you and me. Yeah. That's the way I've always heard it should be. You want to marry me.
Right.
And then, oh,
we'll marry.
We'll marry, yeah. But
with resignation, almost.
With resignation, exactly.
Interesting.
And so that's how the song really came to life, was about the disillusionment of my parents' marriage, which was about walking home at night and tiptoeing by my mother's bedroom. And she calls out, "Sweet dreams, but I forget how to dream." And my father sitting in the living room with his cigarette glows in the dark. And so it's all about the separation of the people who are supposed to be married or supposed to live in one happy house together, who are really not happy and living in that house
together. And how that affects you when you see them. You wrote a book, and a lot of it includes some of your childhood and your marriage and everything. You know, both your marriages, and I think your book only goes up through your first marriage, but the idea being that, you know, what do you leave in and what do you leave out?
Well, you know, this
was... I have to omit something.
This was very important. When I first got asked to write my memoir was in 1986, and I was called on the phone by Jacqueline Onassis, and she said, Carly, I think you would make a wonderful writer of a memoir. And so that's how I started, and I wrote about 60 pages at that point, and realizing that I was leaving out the very nucleus of the story, which was about my parents and their marriage and the thing that happened to their marriage, which was the great divide of having my brother's tutor come to live with us, and he and my mother fell in love, and that was a separate relationship which existed in the same house that she lived in with my father and us and all of the kids. So trying to leave that out was almost impossible when that formed the very essence of me that I was trying
How
to write
so?
About. In the first place, everything was a lie. Everything that I saw as the truth, I was denied the veracity of. And so when I said, well, Mom and Dad are still in love, aren't they, to my older sisters, they'd say, yes, they are. They're very much in love. And then I would ask my mother and father, you know, you don't ever kiss. Can I see you kiss? And my father would bend my mother down in a theatrical kind of bogus kiss.
Bogus.
And it looked strange to me. There was something very off about it, but I was supposed to believe that they were in love.
So they would perform for you?
Yes, that's right.
They would
right.
pretend to mollify you?
Well, once.
And then she was off with the... What was
Ronnie.
The... what was the name?
Ronnie.
And where was Ronnie from?
Ronnie was a teacher... or he was going to teaching school at Columbia at the time. He was 19 and she was 42.
And where was he from, Ronnie?
He was from Pittsburgh.
Ronnie from Pittsburgh.
Yeah. And they were in love for many years. It killed my father, a combination of that relationship that she had with Ronnie and the fact of his relationship at Simon & Schuster, where he started to do things in a way that the accountant who they had brought on board in the company, this guy named Leon Schuster, didn't want him to do. And so therefore my father, at the same time as he became sort of sick with grief over his relationship with my mother, he got more and more out of the loop at Simon & Schuster, and they sort of tried to move him up or out of the mainstream with Max and Leon. And that kind of killed him off further. And then he drank he ate too much ice cream and smoked too many cigarettes, and that made him ill. And so it was a perfect storm, and he died at the age of 60.
Mm. Now, Simon, for people who don't know, the Simon and Simon & Schuster was your father.
Was
he founded
father.
The company.
Yes.
It wasn't his family's business.
Yes, at the age of 24, he met Max Schuster, his old college friend from Columbia. They were both selling pianos at Steinway, I guess, at Steinway & Son. And they said, let's go out to lunch and let's go into business together. Oh, what should we do? What about books? And so they made a little sign which they put on the office at the office space that they'd rented saying, Simon & Schuster, publisher, what, books. And the first book that they published was the crossword puzzle book, which made them a fortune and which started them off with great—
good footing.
With good footing, great speed, opportunities galore. And they were the very center of the publishing world.
And your father was a New Yorker.
Yes, yes.
And your mother, where is she from?
My mother was from Germantown, Pennsylvania. Her mother, Shebe, was Cuban and came to the United States on a banana boat. She was Cuban, but she was from Africa, but her grandmother had spent some time in Cuba. I have the whole lineup.
So are you part black or are you part Cuban or both?
I'm 15% black.
Really?
Yeah.
She's an African, African.
Yes, yes.
Your maternal grandmother.
Yes.
And she was African and went to Cuba.
That's right. That's right. And then she was schooled in England, and so she spoke with an English accent. And she was ashamed of what she probably didn't even know she was, but she bleached her skin her whole life, and so she passed as white. But she spoke with an English accent, and we used to always ask her about what her background was, and she would say, when I die, you will find nothing but nothing, and I never talk about the past. So we weren't able to get very much out of
her. Your mother's mother.
Yes, we weren't able to get anything out of her, but she was such a character.
Did your mother have a career?
My mother did not have an official career, no. She was a singer, and she was a wonderful singer, but her career was raising her four kids.
Now, what was music in your home? I mean, your father from a young age becomes a very successful publisher in New York. I mean,
but
the name is
really a pianist. In fact, when he had a bunch of heart attacks and strokes toward the end of his life, and he didn't have his mind, and he didn't have the capacity of the fullness of his mind, he always thought he was going to Carnegie Hall. When in fact, he was just going downtown to dinner with my mother, and he'd say, "Sissy, you forgot to get off at 57th Street. I'm going to be late." Because he always thought he was going to be playing it. He didn't always think, but once in a while he had the fantasy that he was going to be playing at Carnegie Hall. He was a great pianist.
Classical pianist.
Yes, yes.
So music in your home is classical music?
It was
standards?
Classical on the part of my father.
And a circle of people coming in and out of your home who were celebrities and...
I have two uncles, one on my father's side and one on my mother's side, started jazz magazines. One Downbeat and the other Metronome. So they were very good friends, and they had all the drummers and the jazz players in this house that we lived on 11th Street. So there was music from the jazz era, and then my mother always sang the show tunes because this was the great era of Oklahoma and Carousel and Showboat.
And
Porgy and Bess was actually performed for my mother and father first by George and Ira Gershwin, when they came over to our house. And my mother was asked to sing Summertime, since she had a beautiful soprano voice, for them to see how it would sound in the soprano voice, or to see what it's. I don't know exactly what they went over there for, but my mother ended up singing soprano and on Summertime, and my father ended up correcting a couple of her notes, and that embarrassed her tremendously. And she always used that as the excuse as to why she had an affair and cuckolded him.
No.
One of them, yes.
That's an interesting.
Yes.
Now, your brother, you've got two sisters.
Mm-hmm.
What did your brother end up doing for a living?
My brother's a photographer, very well-known photographer in his field. He's got a bunch of books out, and he started by touring with Bob Marley, and he toured with the Grateful Dead, taking all of their pictures. And then he's, and then he worked, he was the official Mets photographer, and... He's done a wide variety. He's an excellent photographer.
And your sisters?
My sisters are both musicians.
But not performers.
My eldest sister, Joanna, was an opera singer of some merit and quite a lot of class and finesse and stature. Those four things.
Right.
And she was very good besides. And she was a soloist with a lot of different conductors, Eugene Ormandy and what's
she was a New Yorker, or she was with Ormandy in Philadelphia?
She sang with orchestras all over the world. Yes, she sang with Zubin Mehta, Concerto.
So you and your sister played together, correct?
My sister Lucy. Now
Lucy,
she hasn't been mentioned yet.
Right.
She is the middle sister, and she is a composer of music for the Broadway Theater. Mm-hmm. She wrote The Secret Garden.
Of course. So you and Lucy used to perform together?
Lucy and I sang as the Simon and Sisters, yes.
Now where are you going and what do you wish? The old moon asked the three. Well, we're going out fishing for herring fish that live in the beautiful sea. Nets of silver and gold that we said, winking and blinking and nod.
And was that around the time that you were in your mid-20s when you were about to break out with your
It was a little solitaire? Earlier. It was when
so a bit earlier than
it was
that.
When I was in college.
Where'd you go?
I went to Sarah Lawrence.
Of course you did.
No, why?
No, I'm kidding. That's a joke. And you were singing with her in what, clubs in Manhattan? Or?
We decided one summer. She had learned some chords on the guitar, and we only had one guitar, but we wanted to spend the summer. We wanted to go up to the Cape for the summer, so we hitched up to the Cape.
Was the Cape always a part of your childhood? Was that the Simon family?
Yes, yes.
It was a part of your childhood?
Martha's Vineyard was. Right. And so we basically hitchhiked up to the Cape with one guitar and went to Provincetown, and we got a job there, and we had to learn immediately some more chords on the guitar. But we kept on switching around guitars,
right.
And we played things like the Banana Boat song, which we didn't know that my grandmother had any part of being a part of at that point. But we sang other Harry Belafonte songs, too, and we sang folk songs. We sang some Joan Baez, but we expanded our repertoire that
Michael rowed
that
the
summer.
Boat ashore.
Oh, yes. Yes, definitely.
Yeah,
and they built
Pete
the ship
Seeger.
Titanic.
When does it change and when? Because when I think of you, just not only in your work, the quality of your work, the beauty of your work, the range of your work, the songs in terms of them, some being fun and playful and some being really sad. All of a sudden you go from, you know, being this child of privilege in Manhattan and you're this famous family and everything, then all of a sudden you become a big star. Was that difficult for you?
It was difficult on many levels.
How so?
It was difficult because it was actually the summer that Lucy and I played in London. It was 1965, and it was the summer of the Beatles, and it was the summer of the King's Road, and it was such a great time. And I fell in love with an Englishman who was sort of a manager and a mentor. And Lucy fell in love with a man that she was seeing, a doctor who she was seeing back here. And when we had a kind of a falling out over Sean Connery, actually, which is in my book, we imagined ourselves to be sort of vying for his attention. In some quirky way, it went around to that. And when we got back to the United States after that summer of 65, we stopped singing together. Whether it was because of that rift over Sean Connery.
Sean.
Over Sean. Or whether
007.
It was 007. Or whether it was the fact that Lucy was in love with her husband, who's still her husband, David. We kind of went our own separate ways. And I got courted by Albert Grossman and John Court, who were Dylan's managers. And they called me over to Gross Court. It was that period, the day before Bob Dylan's motorcycle accident. I met with him, with Bob Dylan, and he rewrote a song for me that was an Eric Von Schmidt song called Baby Let Me Follow You Down. And he rewrote it for me, and as he was rewriting the words, he was very high. This was the cause of his accident. I don't think it's any secret is that he was really going nuts with drugs at that point. But he stretched out his arms like this, like that, and said, just believe me. You got to go to Nashville. Go to Nashville and do your record there. And then the next day he was in.
Even back then.
Yeah, this was just, I guess, after, was it after Nashville Skyline? No, it couldn't have been. No. No, but he had just done some recording in Nashville, and he thought that that was the place that I should record my record. But because he was just getting together with the band at that point. So, and I was getting together with Robbie Robertson to go into the studio and do some work with that song that Bob Dylan had written for me, as well as a song called Just Because I Asked a Friend About Her, a George Jones song, is it? He thinks I still care in the case of me. And so I worked with Robbie for that week, went into the studio, had a bad couch experience with the engineer who put the song in the wrong key for me. I sang it and what was supposed to come out as...
What does bad couch experience mean?
It means, you know, the Hollywood couch experience.
Oh, someone tried to couch you.
Well, I wouldn't be...
You refused to be couched.
I refused to be couched, and so they kind of sabotaged, I felt, that recording session.
Oh, you felt that in response to your...
Yes.
Anti-couching policy,
yes,
he sabotaged
yourself. Because I got up from the couch and I said, I am not that green. Not knowing
right.
what I meant at all, but I thought green was a good color to say I wasn't.
So you feel that he might have been some malicious tinkering with the song?
Well, yes, and I was shelved at Columbia because that was the label I was going to be on. This was 1966.
Right.
So I was shelved for 3 years, at which point I became a fat secretary.
What does that mean?
I worked for a television production company. And
where?
In New York? It was called Canaan Productions in New York.
Where was their offices?
On 57th Street.
Near CBS, west, way west?
That's right. It was.
And you did that for how long?
A year.
Not three years, a year.
Yes, but I was fat for 3 years.
Now, for you, what's fat? You're like 10 pounds overweight?
No, I don't. I think I weighed about 165 or 170.
And you got there as a result of what?
There was this thing that was advertised as milkshakes, and they were to be bought at this place on 45th Street, and they were advertised, and they were the most delicious things you'd ever tasted, but it promised that they were only 47 calories, and that they were all really ice, that what you were eating was ice.
What was it called?
I don't remember. But the lines were around the block. It was a sham, at any rate.
And so, you were eating this beverage,
thinking that I was losing weight. I was eating them.
They were advertised as diet shakes.
Stash them in the freezer and eat them for weeks and gain weight and more weight and more weight.
Oh my God!
Well, I met Jake around that time too. At the end of that period. During that period of working for Canaan Productions is when I started working for their TV show called From the Bitter End. And I was the talent.
Club The Bitter End.
Yes, right. But it was a TV show that was based on The Bitter End. So they had performers such as Marvin Gaye, and they had the same type of performers that would be at the actual Bitter End, and I was the person who would take them tea and would see that they were happy and happily ensconced in their dressing room.
Yeah, but when the song with Jake, that's the way I always heard it should be. Came out was what year?
1970.
And what happens? You become famous. You become successful.
Well, all right. So then I made my first album, which I thought was going to be a collection of demos. And that's the way I've always heard it should be, was on that record. Jack Holzman thought it could be, you know, it could, if I promoted this record, it could possibly be something. And he asked me to perform. And I was asked, actually, on the basis of the album, to open up for Cat Stevens at the Troubadour. This was in 1971. Just after the record had come out, which was the end of 70. And so I said, oh, no, you know I don't do that kind of thing. This album is just for other singers to hear and hopefully pick out a song for them. But Jack Holzman and Steve Harris, the A&R man at Elektra, were persistent, and they said, well, what would it take to get you to perform with Cat Stevens, to open for Cat Stevens, who has asked for you to open his act. And I was thinking on my feet, and I'd been reading Rolling Stone, and I followed James Taylor's career. I didn't know him, but I was following his career because I thought he was absolutely, totally great. And I knew that he was on the road, and so I also knew his whole band. And I said, okay, get me Russ Kunkel as a drummer, because I knew Russ was on the road with James. And so the next day... It's amazing how things work. The stars are aligned. The next day, I got a call from Jack Holzman saying, okay, well, Kunkel's available. When do rehearsals start? And I said, what do you mean Kunkel's available? And I said, well, James was just in an accident, in a motorcycle accident yesterday. All these motorcycle accidents changing
yeah, right.
my life.
Right.
And so...
Be careful what you wish for.
So,
because Kunkel's on his way.
Kunkel's on his way. So I started rehearsals the next week. With Jimmy Ryan, who became my guitarist for many, many years, and Paul Glantz, a friend of Jimmy's. And the three of us rehearsed in New York for 3 days, and then we went out to L.A., rehearsed with Russ for 1 day, And by that time, I had—
Open for Cat Stevens.
Open for Cat Stevens on April 6th, 1971.
April 6th.
Yes.
And that changed things for you?
That was, that was a convincing night. We played two shows every night and four shows on the weekend. I met all kinds of people. It was like the lights
were
shining
it.
On me.
You're it.
I couldn't say no at that point. And even though I was suffering tremendous stage fright, I had various things that tricked me out of being afraid.
Did you move to L.A.?
No.
You never lived in L.A.?
No.
Why?
Well, I lived in L.A. for various— when James and I got married, we lived in L.A. to make certain records there. But
you visited L.A. or did you live there?
We rented houses.
Right.
In fact, the house that O.J. Simpson bought after—
In Rockingham?
We lived in, yes.
Did he like L.A.?
Did James like L.A.? I think we both found it agreeable, and it was convenient while we were recording. The studios were right there.
That was a different L.A. too.
Sally was, actually both the kids were just brand new and were able to be with— we could take them to the studio, and there was no school to be involved. You know, it was great. It was really great the years that we—
Where did he like to live? What was home to him?
Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah, that's home to him.
Yes.
He's most comfortable there.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, but he's most comfortable there. Not a New Yorker either.
No, I don't think either of us were really in. We kept on trying to figure out what to do all the time in New York. Neither of us really knew what to do.
How did poaching Kunkel for your recordings in L.A. lead you to, and you don't have to talk about this if you don't want to, your first marriage?
Well, I met James the first night that I was performing at the Troubadour. He came backstage into the dressing room to, I don't know, see Russ or see me or whatever, and he was just kind of sitting there in the corner until Joni Mitchell came in and said, "Come on, James, we have to leave now." So that's the first time I actually met James, even though we'd passed and met a couple of times on the Vineyard in a peripheral kind of way. As youngsters, as very young kids, we'd met.
He and his family had been up there as well.
Yes,
when he was there.
Yes.
And then how soon after that did you get married?
Well, then we re-met. After that, we re-met the following Thanksgiving. Well, the Thanksgiving of 1971. I went to his show at Carnegie Hall, and I went backstage in between acts. And I said to him, you know, we said hi again, and how are you? And it was just in between the show, and everybody was drinking beer, and James's band was hanging out. And James said, and I said to James, you know, if you're ever in New York and you want a home cooked meal, please give me a call. And he said, how about tonight? And so that was the first of many home cooked meals.
It was one big home cooked meal.
One large home cooked meal.
I'm sure with someone who is as talented as you, and who made so much music as you have, so much great music, someone who's as gifted as you, there must be countless moments like that. But share one with us of when you were doing it, whether you're in a studio or you're performing or you're doing a duet with somebody, something in your life as a musician that it just sticks with you as like, this is it. This is what it's all about.
There's so many. I'm very lucky that so much comes to my mind. That it's very hard to pick out one because there are many, many. Which one do you want?
Give me one. Give me one from...
Well, give me a hint.
Well, give me one from when you did the songbook, when you did the Sanders album.
Stephen came to the studio, to the recording studio while I was recording it, which was live with an orchestra. Not a Day Goes By. Right. And I was pretty tense that Stephen Sondheim,
of course,
the great Stephen Sondheim, mm-hmm. who'd written the song that I was singing, was in the studio.
And very proprietary about his material.
Yes. And so I was in the vocal booth, and there's a little window in a vocal booth. And so I wanted to avoid the window because he could see me through the window. So I hunched down on my knees. I got down on my knees and did the vocal sitting on my knees in a slightly compromising position because I just had to hunch down. And then I got up and it was under the circumstances, a pretty good vocal. And I got up afterward and I walked back into the control room and his head was in his hands and he was weeping. With tears of gladness, I'm happy to say.
What a wonderful thing. Oh, God.
So that's pretty heraldic.
Not a day goes by. not a single day. But you're someday.
Coming up, Carly Simon talks about the roots of her stage fright. I talked to another musician from New York, this one from Queens, who also defined his generation.
People weren't prepared for what it is that I was in the world that I came from. Nobody said, well, will you make your living as an artist? Like, that wasn't a possibility. Certainly you couldn't make your living as a rock and roll artist. And, I mean, forget about, like, the greatest songwriters or something like that. Just even a songwriter.
Take a listen to my entire conversation with Paul Simon at heresthething.org. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Carly Simon has earned every bit of fame she's achieved, but one could argue she was destined for stardom. Her childhood was peppered with remarkable characters. Albert Einstein at the dinner table, Jackie Robinson playing second base in her backyard. As a grown-up, she amassed her own exceptional circle of friends. One spontaneous evening that I will never forget, I was lucky enough to count myself among them.
I get the call from Jim, your ex-husband Jim Hart, and Jim calls me and says, now Carly and I would love you to come to the house, and we're going to have a quick al fresco meal. Don't be late. It'll be you and Carly and I, and a mystery guest. I get to the house, and you know who shows up, and I'm apoplectic. You know, I mean, I was beside myself. I didn't know what to say. Because she turned to me, Jacqueline Kennedy, and she said to me, so tell me about acting. She said, I want you to talk to me about acting, because my son John is very interested in acting. And literally, I remember looking at her going, you want me to talk to you about acting? I said, you're kidding, right? I thought, how could this be possible? But did you feel, you're friends with the former First Lady of the United States, one of the most famous women that ever lived, and other friendships of yours that I've known, Mike and Diane, you were very good friends with Nichols and his wife. And is that easier for you? Did you find in your life that as your life progressed for you, was it easier to be friends with people who had the same kind of issue of fame and so forth as you did?
I don't think so.
No.
I don't think that really had very much to do with it. I mean, I met Jackie originally because of the book idea that she had and because—
But she was working in that business.
She was working at Doubleday, but right. I also met her on the Vineyard before at a party at the Styrons. And Bill and Rose Styrons,
right.
Who see the Vineyard has a population that includes a lot of great sort of literary figures,
right.
Bill Styron and Art Buchwald, John Hersey and Mike Wallace. Lillian Hellman was actually the first of those people, and she probably attracted the Styrons up there, and it just became an enclave, that particular area of the Vineyard. And so when James and I got married, we were half in that scene and half in the Carpenters, just the people who were building our house, and we played volleyball with out on the lawn and went clamming with. But there was a kind of a nice mélange of those two groups. And James and I were not the only people who straddled both sides. Because I don't necessarily think it's easier to be with celebrities. I think if you have friends, in the first place, I think it's very hard to make friends past the age of 30.
That's interesting you say that.
I find that a lot of the celebrity friends that I've made because the attraction of the similar celebrities attract or something, they're not wholesome in a certain way. And it's a little bit like being with a record company when you don't have a successful record. And the first record that you've had that's really successful, you get a fur throw for your bed, you know, and then the next one you haven't done that well and you get a Cartier pen. And then finally you've really dropped off the charts and you get like a little basket that's filled with shredded paper and a shampoo from Kiehl's. And so in that way, it's a little bit when you're sort of courting the friendship of somebody that you're a new friend with and you're so excited that you've made this friend who you've admired from afar for so long. And you sort of, you court them with attention and things that don't don't continue as you get to know them, or they offend you once, or there's a falling out, or there's a disruption, or there's a jealousy, or there's something, and then there's a, you know, the first year of courting, there's a great gift. Now I'm talking about the metaphor of a gift, because it can come in all different ways, and then it decreases down to, you know, the Santa Claus slippers. And there's a kind of a feeling that you're only as good as your last present from them is, and you're so easily wounded by things that they do, or if they don't write you as long an email back as you've written to them, you know you count the number of lines that you've written. Here, I wrote this whole long letter about what you meant to me and all the things we did together, and then they answer you back saying, "I'll file that away, love."
You know, I find that for me, I'm remarried and I've got little kids, and I've got a 3-year-old, a 1.5-year-old, and a 5-month-old. We've had 3 kids in 3.5 years.
Oh, my Lord.
I have exactly what I wanted, but my friends fall off because I've had this choice. Now, I've got my kids. My wife is my dear friend.
What about friends from high school?
I'm in touch with one guy from high school, and he lives in Norman, Oklahoma. But I'm not into high school. Like I say in my book, high school was a skin that I shed.
Ah.
All I care about is now.
Can you discipline yourself to that degree?
It just happened to me automatically.
What
it was
about
like, it was
dreams? Like, don't they refer to the past?
I just don't want those things to intrude. Sometimes they're like
about,
a cancer
what
on
about
my
deja
life
vu?
Now.
I mean, the smells, the things that you eat, the sensory,
probably the only beautiful
memories.
Things and good things, you know? I mean, I walked around after a very corrosive custody battle, and even when I thought it had subsided, I'd be having dinner with somebody who they'd mentioned themselves or someone close to them whose circumstances mirrored mine, and it would come right back to me if you could see the sparks coming off my fingertips. You know, I was so charged.
But what about all the good things, too? I mean—
That's different. That's different.
But how can you segregate them to that degree?
It's just how do you write a song?
Well, that's
how do you sing the way you do? It's a talent. You
I have to take my feelings. I can't expurgate in the same way that you seem to be able to. I mean, I write about things that I feel, and the past and the present and possibly the future merge. And I can't possibly tell you that my past isn't just as much a part of my present as my it is. You're a combination. Your wholeness becomes, it's parts of, it's like your building blocks of your years.
So for the person who was preternaturally shy, it seems, you didn't really enjoy performing. You've always are quoted as saying, what do you do? I mean, as you have a preparation before you fly in an airplane, was there a preparation before you performed live?
Well, you want to get back to the origins of why I'm so afraid to be in the spotlight?
Yes.
Or is that, I mean, because I had a terrible stammer for ever since I could talk.
So your mother told you to sing?
So she told me, yes.
Pass me the butter.
But that didn't always work at school. I couldn't do that. They didn't have butter at school. And so I every time I was called upon in class, even if I knew an answer, I couldn't say it. But I didn't want to admit that I couldn't say it. So the choice was to just pretend that I didn't know it, or pretend, or just go, which would you do? So I pretended that I didn't know the answer, and that I never wanted to be called upon. And that just graduated to the same thing in college. I mean, the same situation in class in college, and the same situation. I am afraid to talk. I am doing so now by the very skin of my chinny chin chin.
Right.
Whereas I mixed a metaphor.
So what was the preparation before you would perform?
Well, at least my band members would all have to hit me, spank me. That was one
back
thing.
On the couch again?
No, that wasn't on the couch.
Right.
That was definitely in just before I'd go on stage, so that the physical pain would override the emotional struggle.
To distract you.
Yes, yes.
That's interesting.
Yeah, just as when I was once sitting with Stephen Sondheim on a piano bench, he was working on that show called Merrily. And I was starting to have an anxiety attack and just getting more and more thinking that my heart was going to beat out of my chest. I was so scared. It wasn't, there was no reason to be. I was just having an anxiety attack. And so I pinched my earlobe thinking that the physical pain again would distract me from the emotional fear. And the blood started pouring out of my ear onto my white shirt. So, I mean,
good God.
Yeah, but I'll do anything to avoid that mental pain. That I remember Johnny Ray was a singer from the 50s who would cry when he would sing. And I'm the same way. There are some songs I can't get through.
Like what?
Well, just recently, that's the way I've always heard it should be. I was singing that for a group of people who were trying to learn it because we were going to do it for a concert on Martha's Vineyard. And I got to the verse about, you say we'll soar like two birds through the clouds, but soon you'll cage me on your shelf. I'll never learn to be just me first by myself. And it just all came flooding back, all the feelings of being possessed and wanting to possess and wanting to combine. We're just sitting here as human beings, so much wanting to merge, and yet we can't. And it's so frustrating.
We can't.
So we're sitting here.
Is it that you mean you can't and you and that partner, or we meaning all of us can't?
All of us can't.
Oh, isn't that amazing? Oh, God, I'm listening to you say this. And you're such an authority on love.
There are times that we can.
I'm so sorry I asked you to come here now.
One of the things that does make you blend more easily, that acts as a lubricant to being able to pass yourself to another person, is music. And it is the thing that is the common denominator. It's something that you listen to at the same time, you feel at the same time. It goes through your body at the same time. The vibrations, the actual vibrations, you are felt in your body, and that's a way to merge. That's certainly was my way of merging, because that's something that I could do. But merging together, when James and I used to sing together, that was about as great as it got.
You felt that way?
Yes, absolutely.
You think he felt that way? Did you think he dug doing that with you too?
Would he tell
you that?
I don't know.
Would he share how he felt with you?
No.
He's pretty reticent.
Yeah, he wouldn't say that. But my kids would and do, and I sing with them. And we are as one when we sing. My uncle, he would always end everything that he did with this song called Look at the Bluebirds and the Blackbirds. Do you know that song?
No.
I don't know why I thought of it, but I'm going to sing it if I remember it. Look at my doorstep, look at my doorstep, look at the bluebirds, look at the blackbirds, look at the good luck, look at the bad luck, look at the good luck and the bad luck. There wit never knew bluebirds, knew any blackbirds, never knew blackbirds, knew any bluebirds, never knew good luck ever to perch out there. I overheard boom, 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 those birdies talking, boom, 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 and this is what they had to say. Now first the bluebird said, you gotta have sunny weather. So the bluebirds and the blackbirds got together. And then the blackbirds said, we're birds of a different feather. So the bluebirds and the blackbirds got together. Oh, well, when they talked it over, they let the blackbirds bring the rain. And then the bluebirds all agreed to bring the sunshine again. But you can't have rain or sunshine that lasts forever. You can take those bluebirds, you take those blackbirds, you put them together, you get fair weather. And that's the reason the bluebirds and the blackbirds got together. I did it in his key and not in mine, but what the hell.
Live.
Jesus.
Martha's Vineyard Zone. Carly Simon. Thank you.
Thank you.
After our interview, I realized I still had a couple more questions for Carly Simon, so I called her up.
Hello?
Hey, it's Alec.
Hey, Alec.
Who were the people who were your contemporaries, who you worked with, who made the deepest impression on you?
Well, it would have to be certainly James Taylor. I mean,
now why?
Well, before I met him, I listened to his music, and it stirred something very immediate and heartfelt, and specific. I mean, there was an arrow that was directly from him to me. You know, one of the things that the incredible pain that I feel from not having that returned, you know, from not having that accepted. In other words, that James will not talk to me, and that's not a mutual thing, and I don't know why. And,
right.
and it's one of those things where you have to go on and live the destiny of your life by yourself. His music had a tremendous effect on me. Cat Stevens did too, because I was listening to a lot of his music around that time. But then there were all of the great musicals of the 40s and 50s, especially Guys and Dolls and Kiss Me, Kate, and Brigadoon, South Pacific. And then there were the operas like Amahl and the Night Visitors, the Menotti operas, and because there was so much music of different types going around my house. Joey was the person who brought in the classical music, but so did my father, because he played he played such a variety of classical music on the piano, and then Joey was the opera singer, and she brought that into the house in that form, and then my mother was the one who primarily listened to the theater music, but my uncles were both the founders of jazz magazines, and they were the ones that listened to Dave Brubeck and Lambertz, Hendricks, and Ross, and brought those people. You know, so there was a whole huge variety of visitors in my head of all kinds of music. I would say that other than polkas, I didn't listen a lot to polkas. And I wasn't very much into country music at that time either. I mean, it hadn't made itself into mainstream. But yeah, I didn't love the twang.
You sing all these songs about love. Thoughts about love are in so many of your songs. Who's the love of your life?
Well, I guess my kids, without question. I think you probably understand that.
Yeah.
It's just it's breathtaking how much on a different level it exists, but it teaches you about a brand new level, and as far as romantic love, I don't necessarily want to go there, because that doesn't necessarily last as long as the other kind of soul love. I mean, I suppose there must be some people who favor one child over another, and that must be very hard for them to say, well, that it's both of my kids or three of my kids, when it's really only one. I haven't had that experience, because I love my children equally and so much, and there's a lot left over.
This is Alec Baldwin. Here's The Thing Comes from WNYC Studios.